Rio de Janeiro
with a big man.
G'day, kaya, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Frio de Janeiro. My name is Abid Imam, and this show is all about engaging conversations with inspirational personalities and public figures to help us understand people, culture, and the world. On this edition, we are joined by Tracy Holmes, one of the world's greatest sports journalists, a master interviewer, and as we get to discover during the conversation, a world explorer who is an expert at storytelling. She started her career at the ABC in 1989, and her wonderful work over three decades has seen her become one of Australia's most senior and respected sports journalists. She's covered major issues in sports business, politics and governance. Tracy's been on the ground for numerous Olympic Games and World Cups and spoken to the who's who of world sport leadership. There's also a really long list of accolades for Tracy, from Lifetime Achievement Awards to recognition from the International Olympic Committee. Tracy's value set really aligns to the show, so we talk about her experiences across the world, speaking with people from all different walks of life, her views on having a sense of perspective and making the most of your time in this world. It's a conversation with many profound learnings. This show itself couldn't be where it is without your support, so please give me a review and subscribe to help support Frio de Janeiro's storytelling. So enjoy this conversation with Tracy Holmes, one of the world's finest sports ambassadors. Tracy Holmes, it's an absolute pleasure for you to join me on Frio de Janeiro. As a long-time listener to the show of The Ticket and to your wonderful journalism covering big stories in sport across the world, I'm very, very excited that you can join me. And you're someone who really resonates with what this show is all about in terms of sport, culture, inclusion, understanding the world, and leadership. So it's a real honor that you can join me.
Actually, Abid, the honor is mine. Because, you know, I absolutely love it when I meet other people who are fascinated by the same sorts of things as me. And, you know, that is the world and there's so many interesting stories that there are in the world and the many people you can meet across it, but also how we approach all the differences amongst us, you know, and that brings challenges. And I think the only way to bring challenges are to talk about them and to try and navigate a way forward. And so the conversations you have are, you know, very much along those lines as well. So thank you.
Pleasure. And speaking about the world, Tracy, I know that early on in your life you had many formative experiences being able to live in different countries. I'd love to get started into how that has shaped you and those experiences growing up in different nations.
Yeah, I was pretty lucky because I was born in Manly on the northern beaches of Sydney, and my mum and dad were surfers, and it was the hippie era. My dad made boards. My mum and dad both competed. They worked in surf factories. They worked at opposing surf factories, actually, one where my dad made the boards and my mum looked after customers who were buying boards or buying board shorts or whatever the clothing range was at the time. And I was a little baby that used to be in a bassinet under the counter, and most people didn't even know that I was there. So I think I heard all these voices and stories, you know, that they were part of my sort of very, very early days. And then when I was about 2.5, mum and dad heard that the surf was really good in South Africa. So we hopped on a boat, and it took about, I think, 14, 16 days to sail to South Africa. And, of course, when we got there, there were many fantastic things but also many tragic things because it was the era of apartheid, which was not pleasant. But given that mum and dad were explorers and adventurers and surfers, we had a combi van. We hopped in that with all the boards and, you know, some clothes and blankets, and we'd sleep in it, drive in it, eat in it, and travel through some areas of South Africa that many people didn't experience, you know, many of the locals, because it was so separate between black and white. So we got to see, or I got to see firsthand at a very young formative age, what this sort of racism thing can do, and it was pretty awful. And I just remember thinking the whole time, but these people are exactly the same. And people have often said that to me when they've, I mean, later in life, when they say, oh, I'm looking for so-and-so, do you know who he or she is? And I'll go, oh, yeah, yeah, they're down there. They've got a black shirt, blue tie, or wearing a green dress or whatever. And afterwards they'll come and see me and they go, oh, why didn't you just say they were Chinese or they were black? And it's like, probably because I didn't really notice because I just think people are people and I don't kind of see them in the same I don't like labels very much, you know. So when I meet people, I like to see them as a person and probably some of those other things that people make immediate judgments on, I'm not really looking at. And then after we left South Africa, we went to Hawaii, and the same thing, we lived with a Hawaiian family, a very well-known Hawaiian family. They were a family of surfers and lifesavers, and they lived at the bottom of an old Chinese graveyard that they were caretakers of. And so we just moved into the house with them, and my mum learnt to drive through the old tombstones because there was never anybody around. I went to school across a little bridge. It was just over a little creek that separated the Chinese graveyard from the school. So I had some pretty interesting childhood experiences, and I think that really set me off on, you know, the journey that I continue to this day.
Your parents were into surfing, and I understand the ocean has a lot of significance to yourself. And how did your surfing prowess go?
Not very good. Mum, of course, I always had a surfboard. My sister, who's 4 years younger than me, she became a pro surfer. That was never going to be on the cards for me because I just really, first of all, I'm quite fussy about waves that I like to surf in. So the temperature's got to be really good. The waves have got to be about this high. They've got to be quite gentle. I've got to be able to have a really nice time on the waves. It needs to be offshore wind, you know, so this doesn't happen very often when all of those things are perfect. So by no means was I a competitive surfer, even though I competed all the way through school. And what I'd normally do is paddle out the back, and traditionally heats are of four people, so there'd be me and three others, and I'd sit out there and I'd talk to all my opponents and they'd be catching all these waves and coming back out and I'd pick up the story again and I'd find out all this stuff. I'd find out all their life stories and it was fascinating. But I wouldn't have caught any waves and so I would be eliminated and not get through to the next round, which I was always pretty happy about. But my sister sort of carried on the tradition. She became a pro surfer. Then at one point she was a vice president of the World Surf League. Wow. And has continued to work for many of the major events.
That's amazing. You know, something about surfing that's so fascinating is that connection between the surfer and the ocean and that spirituality, you could use that word. How did you feel that connected you with the ocean and that love for it?
I think what it does is it's not just a connection with the person and the ocean, but I think it's a connection with the world, because if you look at the world surfing circuit, and it travels to all sorts of different places, you know, from the small islands in Hawaii and Tahiti to wherever you want to go. I mean, they surf everywhere. It's that ocean that connects everybody, and all the different countries around the world and the continents are all connected by the same water. You know, the water just keeps flowing from one side to the other. And that has always amazed me. And one of the greatest things, whenever I feel, which is not very often, you know, stressed or I'm thinking about something and can't sort of progress to that next level, I love to dive in the ocean, because suddenly it's like all of that just washes away and you're part of this energy. And, you know, when you go under the water, you hear different sounds. It's a different world. But you hear the bubbles. You hear the bubbles of the ocean, and it's like these are the bubbles of energy that wash over all of us, and it washes up on the shores of Australia, whether you're in Perth or Sydney or wherever. It washes up on the shores of Argentina. It washes up on the shores of Israel and Gaza. It's one water. And I like to think of it that way, and I like to think of people as, you know, one humankind that populate the land. And in that respect, you know, that's the yin and the yang that makes the world go round.
There's so much we don't know about the ocean as well. At the same time, it's such a a wonder. You just look out into the sunsets here, and we're very lucky here in Perth to have beautiful sunsets, and you just think about what's on the other side, you know, what's that mystery?
Well, I think about that with the early explorers, you know, how courageous they were when they used to think that the earth was flat. But they'd hop in a boat and they'd go, okay, I want to find out what happens when you fall over the edge, or if it just keeps going and we can't see what's on the other edge. Those early explorers were amazing. And I think it's a real shame that at school we hardly ever learn about other explorers. We learn about our own and maybe, you know, one or two others. But I know when we moved to China as a family and I started to learn about Zheng He, I heard this story about their great Admiral Zheng He, who travelled through many parts of the world, and everywhere he went and encountered a different religion, he would convert to that religion to learn more about it, and then he'd bring things back to China with all the stories about these other places. And there are rumours that he also, or more than rumours actually, that he came to the top of Australia because he charted Northern Australia and some of the eastern seaboard, and there are maps in the National Museum in Taiwan. But, you know, I remember learning about him in China and thinking, gee, so many people would love to know these stories. And then when we moved to the Middle East and we were living in Dubai at one point, and there was a mall just out of Dubai called Ibn Battuta Mall. And the first time I went there, I thought, Ibn Battuta, what's Ibn Battuta mean? So went in and learnt that Ibn Battuta was their great explorer. And inside Ibn Battuta Mall was this great replica ship. And I thought, oh, maybe it was Ibn Battuta's. And I walked over and it was a replica of Zheng He's boat, the Chinese explorer. And I thought, wow, I love that. I love learning those things and, you know, suddenly discovering that there are all these different links through time and through many hundreds of years that actually keep joining people. You know, it's like life is like a journey of dots. It's like traditional First Nations artwork, you know, dot paintings. It's the dots that create the big picture. You know, it's the dots that join one thing to the other. And, you know, that's why I love life.
And part of the dots and explaining the dots and telling the truth of the dots was journalism. And I really am fascinated with how you fell into it. Some say, or you've actually said before, that it sort of came to you by accident.
Yeah. It was an accident. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I had, I suppose, like many kids, yeah, I'll be, you know, an astronomer. Actually, I want to be an astronaut. What else could I be? I thought of all sorts of things. I thought maybe I'd go and work for ASIO. That would be a good way of, you know, traveling the world and learning about other people. And, I mean, in the end, I was just dreaming. But my mum rang up one day and said, it was not long after I'd finished my HSC, and she rang me up. It was about 11 o'clock in the day, and she goes, were you still asleep? I said, yeah, I was. And she said, okay, right, when I get home from work, you're either to have moved out, found a job, or enrolled in a course. Now, just to point it out, I had worked all the way through school, right, on surfing contests and in surfing shops and doing different things. So I wasn't immune to work. I was just being a little bit slow in deciding what I was going to do next. So I rang up a friend of mine and asked if she had a spare room. Could I move in? Didn't know how I was going to pay rent, but would cross that bridge when I got to it. She said yes. I rang up Sydney TAFE and saw they had a sort of PR, sort of communications type course. So I enrolled in that, rang up the place where I'd been working through my school holidays, asked if they had anything more permanent. They said yes. So I did all three things at once. Mum got home and I was gone. But in studying public relations, this is amazing, and this is how sometimes, you know, the world works in mysterious ways. My first teacher was a partner in a PR company, and about 2 weeks into the course, she said to me, listen, I'd really like to give you a job. Would you like to come and work in our company? And I said, yeah, sure, that sounds good. The week I started there, this company got contacted by the world professional surfing circuit at the time, and they said, we were wondering if your company would like to do all of our media work when we come to Australia for the three or four different events that we have in Australia each year. And so everyone looked at each other and went, this is unbelievable. Like, Tracy starts the same week they come to us, and she knows everything about surfing, so yes, let's go. And so one thing led to another. I ended up working for the Bicentennial Authority in 1988, and there were so many sporting events, and I was doing some of the media, or all of the media, for 1,500 events or more. And through that, there weren't actually enough sports reporters to get to all of the events. So I'd go to some events and then phone up AP and give them a report, or I'd phone the ABC and give them a report. I was just providing free reports as part of my job. And at the end of that year, the ABC rang up and said, listen, would you be interested in applying for a traineeship as a sports commentator? We need women. Women never apply, hardly ever apply, and we think you might have what it takes. So I applied and I got the job, and here I am.
What a story. I love those sliding doors moments, you know, just that. How did that surfing competition have that relationship with that PR company? How did that happen? And if that didn't happen, what would have happened, you know?
Exactly. And it's really fascinating. You know, often people say, oh, you know, regrets. People always ask old people, you know, do you have any regrets? And I'm one of those that always believes no, because you made a choice and these are the results of the choice. You know, you can't go back in time. And it always is interesting thinking, okay, well, if that didn't happen, which door would I have gone through? But in the end, you know, you can't go back and relive it. And I'm pretty happy with how it's worked out so far.
And in life and in business, we all need mentors and people who might not have that role as a mentor, but you look back and think, oh, yeah, they were that really important part in my career. And one of the names I hear is Peter Longman, and wanted to dig into what he meant and how he supported you.
Well, if you ask Peter Longman, you'd probably get a different answer to the one I'll give you. But for me, he was the New South Wales sports editor when I started at the ABC as a trainee. And so he effectively was overseeing a team of men. And then I came in. Debbie Spillane had been there for a short time a little bit earlier, but there really hadn't been very many women for very long, and it's challenging. It is hard, and so, you know, they tended to move on, the very early ones. And so he made it quite comfortable for me. It was obvious that they didn't know how I was going to fit into the team, exactly what that looked like, how much guidance and support I would need. And I think I'm one of those people that I like to learn by watching and listening and reading, probably not so good on just sitting there taking instruction. And Peter would agree with that, because a couple of years ago I said, Longie, you know, thinking back to the time when we worked together for so long, he ended up becoming the executive producer of Grandstand, and I took over as, you know, the first female anchor of that program. And he ended up becoming head of sport. Like, he just kept getting promoted, and I was there sort of through all of it. But years later, after he'd left the ABC, and I said to him, you know, I keep getting asked, am I a good team player? And I am, aren't I, Longie? And he said, yeah, Holmesy, you're a great team player as long as the team does whatever you want. And I thought, is it really like that? Maybe it is. But I think, you know, he trusted me. So he gave me that freedom to be able to go and pursue things as I wanted to pursue them, which wasn't the same way it had always been done. And so my fascination, because it's always been with people and not so much, you know, the rules of sport or the minute-by-minute detail of a game or a race, it's always been about the impact of the psychology of those people on that team, or the people that line up for a race and they all come from different places on the planet with different experiences, and here they all are in the same moment, and how's that moment going to unfold, and what does that mean, and what will be the implications of that? And he was really happy to let me to continue to go off on what was a really different tangent to the way sport was usually done. And I think we both benefited from that. And I truly thank him for the support he gave, the freedom he gave, the guidance he gave when I asked, And probably he had my back, you know, in certain circumstances when I probably should have been in more trouble than I was, you know, and he stood up for me.
Looking at your superpower at being able to connect with people, ask questions, I love your interviewing skills, and I think you're one of the best in the world, and you've been able to speak to so many different leaders and athletes and cover that important area, that gray area, as you call it, that you need the right questions, you need the right environment to bring that out. What's your approach to the art of interviewing, how you prepare before you go into an interview?
I do think a lot, if I've got the benefit of time, which I think is so helpful, I do tend to think a lot about it. And I think about, you know, it depends what I'm trying to get out of an interview. So if it's about a person and it's their life, I like to read as much as possible about their life, but what other people or some of their sporting colleagues or family members or workmates have had to say about them to get other perspectives, to build a fuller picture. But then I also like to think about, well, what about people who appear to be quite similar but maybe in a different sport, or maybe that play the same sport but have different personalities? So, you know, if I'm going to do something with, let's just pick a random name, Roger Federer, I'd like to think about, you know, how does Rafa Nadal really see him? And how does Djokovic really see him? And how do players coming through today view the role he's played? And how did people, his early coaches, see him as a kid? And then you sort of build this bigger picture, and so hopefully try and tap into some of the areas that you haven't heard about before. But also I like to take people out of that comfort zone. And in some ways I think it's worse than a comfort zone, because people get interviewed about the same thing over and over and over. And tennis players are a really good example. Mm. If you've sat through a couple of, you know, media interviews at the end of tennis matches for 3 or 4 years at the Australian Open, it's like, are you serious? This person gets asked that question every time they finish a match in 52 different countries in a year, year on year. Like, can we make it more interesting than that? Yeah. And so that's what I like to try and do, and relate something, you know, about what's happening in their country, or, you know, things that are happening, you know, in elsewhere, to try and give them some room to breathe. And I think that's why athletes like LeBron James have been so influential and so incredible in having the courage to step out of that zone of being a pro basketballer and talking about all these other things, and how he can use that, you know, authority that he has through being not just a star performer and an absolute legend of the game and all sport, but by being a leader and being able to use that influence in so many different areas, building schools for kids that would otherwise never have gone to school and would end up having a life on the street, who would end up in prison or drug addicted or dead. You know, so those are the conversations I like to have. And I think about, before I interview someone, I do think about the conversation, and I think, okay, so if I ask that and they answer this way, where would I go? But if they answer this way, where could I take that? And then I try and sort of distill it all down to maybe 4 or 5 key things that I would really like to get out of them. And then I know what those key things are, and that enables me to just have a discussion. I don't like question, answer, because they don't flow. But if you're listening to what people say, and you know where you want to go, you can just weave in those things into the natural course of the conversation.
What has it been like for you when you're talking with somebody or having a conversation with someone who's got a very different value set to yourself? Your values are very strong and you understand what you're about, but then you might be having to have a conversation with someone that can get a bit interesting when they're very different. And one of those could be, oh, there's a number of examples, but what is it like for you when you're thinking about the story, you're thinking about what you're trying to get out of this, and they're having a platform now, also how it aligns with yourself?
I don't think there's any such thing as total objectivity, because we all come to wherever we are through our own experience. And that's impacted by every day of our lives. It's impacted by the people around us, by our education, you know, the experiences we've had as kids and adults, what we've seen happen to other people. So that all plays into forming who you are and how you view the world. But if I'm speaking to somebody and I'm so happy when people who don't think like me agree to talk to me, and I actually I'm very respectful of that. I'm not there to do an interview with somebody to try and prove a point I might believe in, you know, or to push an agenda. I can't stand that. So obviously if I've invited them on, I know that we don't think the same way about things. We haven't had the same experience, and I'd like to understand why they think the way they do or why they're doing what they do. I need to understand that. We all need to understand each other if we're going to make things better. And, of course, I can still learn. I can still be surprised. I can still be shocked or have not considered something before. You know, I think one thing that's very current at the moment that people have been talking about is the enhanced games. So, and I've looked at doping in sport a lot for a long period of time, you know, and I covered the Essendon saga, which some people might not be old enough to even remember or know about. But there are problems in anti-doping. So I certainly don't subscribe to free-for-all because I know what happens when people take too much of something and don't understand the implications of that and have ended up dead on the side of a road instead of finishing a cycling race or something like that. So, you know, I know that there are sort of these rough edges. Mm. Predominantly, I think it's great to have drug-free sport. But I've also thought in my own mind that there are certain things that would help athletes recover from injuries. And if we look at athletes as employees or workers in a particular craft, every time they can't compete, they're losing money, and this is their job. And I know in my job, if I can't do something, if I lose my voice, I can't talk, I can't do my job, well, I'm going to take whatever I can take within reason to bring my voice back so I can work as soon as possible. So I think those sorts of areas of anti-doping have not developed. And so while I don't necessarily agree with an all-in, and this is something that the enhanced games are talking about much more so than the regime we have at the moment, I was fascinated to sort of sit and think about that and hear it in a way where I'm not in my little Olympic sports bubble, but I'm standing outside that, and I can see that there's a multi-billion dollar industry investing in supplements, new medications to treat mental illness, to treat all sorts of, you know, physical ailments, or even just to keep people younger longer. And I don't necessarily subscribe to that either, but it's an industry. I can't pretend it's not there. And particularly in the USA, it's massive. So it's sort of like they exist here, and the world of sport under the WADA code and anti-doping exists here. Like, those two bubbles exist. Mm. One can't deny the other. So there's no point just trying to tear each other down. What we need to do is understand, okay, where are you coming from? That's what you're looking at, which is not our business anyway. And we're looking at this, which is not your business anyway. But in the middle, there's an overlap. And maybe this is where we can help each other. And so that's why I always think discussions with people who think differently or come from a different sort of system are really important, because you can always learn something, even if in the end it's just to learn that maybe you don't agree at all. But you've learned that by having a respectful discussion and at least allowing, you know, them to put their position.
Thank you. And this is one of the benefits of good journalism. And the more I read into what life is like for a journalist, even around the world, I'm quite shocked by reports like the World Press Freedom reports that come out every year about just how difficult it is to be a journalist. And we're not talking about just sport now, but some of those forces and dynamics in those industries around telling the truth or telling your truth are really harsh. And I'm just wanting to know your thoughts on, yes, those, there's sometimes those external factors for a journalist to deal with around government pressure, but then also what it's like when inside your own industry, the ability to tell the truth is quite difficult because of, let's say, agendas or biases. Mm. How have you reflected on that as being from being a journalist?
This is another thing I always like to think about, and that is perspective. And I know that, you know, any situation I've been in, it might be hard at a particular time, but when you line it up against the experiences of some other people, so even my husband, who was a war correspondent for CNN for a long time, nothing that has ever happened to me is going to come close to that. And then he would say, nothing that he experienced is ever going to come close to those who are not just reporting from places that are really fraught, but they actually live there and they're part of that system. Like, that's incredibly difficult. I mean, imagine trying to be a female journalist in Afghanistan when the Taliban rolls back into town. So by no means would I ever want to think that anything I've been through comes anywhere close to the pressures and dilemmas that so many journalists face, journalists who've lost their lives for doing their job. But having said that, yes, there are pressures. And even in places where we say we're free, you know, we live in a free world, we have free press, even we come under pressures. And you look at the moment with what's happening in Israel and Gaza, and there are definitely pressures being applied to report that story in a particular way. And I think, you know, I think it's terrible because you can't really, you can't get a full picture unless you're hearing the full picture. And that also goes to something that is really challenging, because when we talk about truth, truth can be very different from one side to the other. I've got a very close and dear family friend. He's like a brother. And when we lived in South Africa, we became very close with this family. They were, you know, white, Jewish, South African family. And, of course, we've stayed in touch since we were little kids. And, you know, now we're sort of getting to that other end of life where we're watching kids growing up and their kids grow up. So he went back to Israel recently after the tragedy of October 7, and it was horrendous. Any terror attack on any people is horrendous and can't be justified by any means. But his whole reference was that attack. And yet, if you stand back and you look, and again, you take away labels, take away Jewish, take away Israel, take away Muslim, take away Gaza, take away Palestine, you look at people, you look at what's happening to people. What happened on October 7 was horrific. What is happening every day since is horrific, and it continues, but we can't talk about it in the same way because there are pressures applied. And I think that is one of the most difficult thing for journalists. I understand the pressures that Israelis feel and Jewish people feel about being persecuted through history. It's a terrible thing. Equally, it's a terrible thing for those that suffer Islamophobia every day of their lives. Both those things can exist. So both of those things are true. And it's when we're forced to pick one truth over another truth that we end up in trouble. And so one of the hardest things is to sort of always step outside that bubble, any bubble, even the planet. You know, I like to go on this little, it sounds bizarre, but I like to kind of hop in a little imaginary spaceship and head out to space and just look back on planet Earth. Like, here we are. We are all on here. So what are we carrying on about? Why are we attacking each other for these things? When you know, from that perspective, we're so insignificant. And from that perspective, if we don't support each other and try and understand each other, we're just going to keep killing each other. And what's the point of that? So it's hard. It's not easy. It's tragic on so many fronts, but truth has so many shades to it. And I think it's really important to try and understand each of those shades in the best way we can.
Did it feel like another planet when you moved to China?
This is a really funny story because we first moved to Hong Kong and I loved living in Hong Kong. It was just great. When we first arrived, we had an apartment that CNN had found us, which was quite close to the CNN office because my husband was working long hours. But he'd go to work. The two older boys would go to school. I'd have the baby in a pouch and I'd catch this double-decker bus through the national park down to this little fishing village called Sheikh O. And so it's like a little hamlet at the bottom of the national park. And I just loved that place. It was just beautiful. And, you know, people would walk around on the beach. The locals all had bare feet. It was little rickety alleyways and, you know, construction that was completely illegal. It was a real village. Anyway, so on the weekends, I'd say to my husband, let's go to Sheikh O, because I ended up spending half my time there before I started working. And anyway, he said, we should move to Sheikh O. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So he said, okay, well, you do some work through the week and, you know, find a real estate, whatever, and we'll come down on the weekend and have a look at a few places. So I said, okay, great. So the story of Sheikh O is you come down this windy road. It's only one lane and you come into the little village and basically you hit the village as a roundabout. You can turn left and go up onto the headland where there are some houses. You can go around the roundabout this way to the car park of the beach. And then you have to turn around and you go back out the other way, the way you just came in. That's it. That's all there is. So anyway, we go down there on the weekend and we get to the roundabout and we hop out of the bus. And my husband says, so are we meeting some real estate agents or what? And I said, no, because it's a fishing village, like there's no real estate agents or anything. And he goes, well, how are we going to find a house? And I said, I just thought if we stood on the roundabout, someone would help us. And he said, oh, my God, I married this airhead. How did I do that? Anyway, so we're sort of having this argument on the roundabout with three kids. And this Chinese guy comes along and he goes, Stan. And Stan says, mate, what are you doing here? And he said, I live here. And as it turns out, he was one of the photographers and the cameramen at CNN. And he said, I live here. What are you doing here? And he said, oh, my wife's got this pea-brained idea that if we stand on the roundabout, someone's going to rent us a house. And he said, well, you won't believe it, but my cousin actually looks after most of the houses here because there's nothing official. I know there's about eight to rent at the moment. Come on, I'll show them all to you. Wow. And like within half an hour, we had a house.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
But let me just keep going on that. We went from Hong Kong to Beijing when Stan got transferred up there. And completely different. We caught the train on Christmas Eve and we told the three boys who were still quite young, we're on the Polar Express, right? So when we get to Beijing, we're going to be traveling through all these different sort of climates. And when we get there, it's going to be not like this, not like the tropics. It's going to be freezing cold and snowing. But Santa will find you on the train, so don't worry about it. There'll be presents, right? So we hung up their stockings when they fell asleep in their little sleepers and put the presents in. And then we got to Beijing and it was incredible. And so different to Hong Kong, just huge and so many people and so much happening. And I remember saying to my husband, we'd come back for a holiday and fly back to Beijing. And I said to him on one occasion, I know it's weird, but every time I hop off the plane and I smell China, I feel like I'm at home. Like another weird thing, right? And then years later, a cousin of mine who had married a Singaporean Chinese doctor got in touch with me and said, guess what? You won't believe this. Grandma's grandfather was pure Chinese from Fujian province and I've got all the documentations and all the records and the family tree. It's like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. But, you know, it's sort of interesting knowing that as a kid I end up in a little Chinese graveyard in the outskirts of Honolulu, and then as an adult with kids end up moving to China and then moving back from China and finding out that we've got this Chinese ancestry was pretty funny.
Have you explored the languages of China? Have you dabbled a little bit?
Oh, a little bit. So when we first moved to Beijing, I went to the Beijing Language and Culture University, and I did, a sort of introductory course to Mandarin, Putonghua, and learned how to speak and read a few characters. By no means was I top of the class, but it kind of helped. And I think Mandarin is such a beautiful language. And it's probably one of those things that if I ever stop work, and my family doubts that, but if I ever did, I'd really like to, you know, pick it up and actually learn how to speak it much more proficiently.
Are you one to use some of those apps, or have you found any good ways to accelerate your language?
No, I'm always too busy talking to people. This is my problem. You know, when I went to the FIFA World Cup in Qatar 2022, and so this is so funny. I mean, life is so weird. We arrive, and I was with a couple of other colleagues who hadn't been there before. I'm not sure they were even terribly happy to have been on the team. Anyway, I was really happy to go there because I'd been in Qatar. I'd seen it shift, you know, from what it was to what it had become and where it saw itself going. And so I was really happy to be back there to kind of keep monitoring this. We're at the airport and we come out with all our bags, and we go over to the little booth where you can buy, chips for your phone, SIM cards for your phone. And we're trying to negotiate, you know, 5 or 6 SIM cards. We needed a lot of memory. We needed, you know, the best deal we could get. Anyway, while we're standing there, this guy comes over who'd been on the same plane, who was a local, who said, "Tracy, I spend some time in Australia, know who you are, love your work. Let me deal with this. I'll get it sorted. What do you need?" And my colleagues were like, "Oh, my God, you know, and is it okay if he does this?" It's like, yeah, of course it's okay. He lives here. He understands it. Anyway, he did it. And then he said, "I'm going to pay because you're guests in my country." We were like, "No way. We work for the ABC. We can't have anyone pay. We've got to pay ourselves." No, please. So he said, "Okay, well, you can pay, but I'm giving you these gifts." And he had all these Tim Tams and things that he brought from Australia. And my colleagues were just blown away. And we hadn't even left the airport yet. And then all of these sorts of things were happening. But one of the younger ones of the team, she said to me about 3 or 4 days in, "Oh, my God, like you filed about 10 stories. Where do you keep getting these stories from?" And I said, "Well, it's not like I go searching for stories. I just talk to people and suddenly they've told me something." It's like, wow, that's a great story. So in that respect, you know, finding stories and doing journalism in that sense is incredibly easy.
I'd love to know what it's like with that rhythm of a major tournament, and it's good that you mentioned the FIFA World Cup in Qatar 2022. It's one of a multitude of major events that you've done yourself. And in Qatar, I noticed a lot of the content was fantastic. You were outside stadiums and talking to people as they're leaving and getting those emotions from people, some wonderful moments there. But, yeah, what's it like behind the lens and that daily rhythm and the intensity of it all?
It's fantastic. So I've been so lucky to have covered, 14 Olympic Games, numerous FIFA World Cups. In France, 98 was my first one for SBS. I went again with SBS 2006 in Germany, through to Qatar 2022, which was just so phenomenal, being in a completely different part of the world and being able to tell stories that are so different. And I love that. And I got so much feedback from people who saw my stories from Qatar. And I think it might be because they were different to so many of the other stories that they'd been beaten over the head with for 12 years, all about human rights. And I'm certainly not discounting that human rights can be better everywhere, including in our own country. but significant changes were made to the human rights situation in Qatar that still hasn't happened in many of its neighbours, who this country continues to do business with, but it's not a problem. And this is one of the, it's the good and bad, it's sort of like the Achilles heel of sport, that sport enables people to really have a global attention and bring a lot of focus to something, but then it's like sport is to blame and people can't sort of separate those two things. So I think, of course, there's more that sports themselves can do, but there's also a limit to what sport can do. When you're talking about civilizations changing, I mean, that is huge. And that requires a delicate balancing act so that stuff is not just thrown out and into mayhem. These are some of the big challenges of our time. And sport can definitely play a role. So without the FIFA World Cup, nobody would have looked at the human rights of foreign workers.
Yeah.
But the thing that sort of gets me is that a lot of those foreign workers emerged from a place which was far worse, and we didn't see any coverage of that, that they had come to Qatar because Qatar was better. Now, it was by no means optimal and it still isn't, but it improved so much. It laws changed, you know, and attitudes changed, and local people were cognizant of the fact that they were being marked on this, and they did a lot of work. And so I was trying to find some of those other stories, because I reckon about 99% of the Western media that was there, they were just going to keep doing those same stories, and that's fine, they're allowed. I wanted to do other stories because there was so much more happening there, and I was so happy that I did that. But, yes, I came under pressure from the ABC. They didn't want to publish some of the stories that I wrote. I did have numerous heated arguments about the fact that they were now pushing an agenda and that I was not comfortable and I wouldn't push an agenda. I really wanted to, you know, just document what was happening, what the people were feeling. And it was phenomenal. I think it was an amazing World Cup. The first World Cup, I think, since they started measuring, where no English person was arrested, which is fabulous. Yes. Because there was no alcohol. And yeah. So there were no fights. It was superb. It was an incredible World Cup. And I remember thinking, you know, I would, if I was FIFA, I'd probably be thinking, oh, my God, we'll just come back here, you know, every 4 years, because the venues are beautiful and you got the transport system working and there were no backlogs, and, yeah, it was incredible.
We could almost talk about each World Cup, because they all have their own different signature and trademark and beautiful moments as well. Of course, 2023 last year was amazing with us being able to host a FIFA World Cup, and that was a bucket list moment personally to be able to work at. How did that feel for you and your involvement? Because you've been a big supporter of football and so many different threads of that tournament.
Yeah, I remember when the first FIFA Women's World Cup was held, and Australia hadn't qualified, it was 91 in China. But Heather Reid, who has done so much for women's football over the years, she was the chief executive of the Women's Football, Australian Women's Football Federation at the time. She went up to Beijing, and I organised to be able to do reports with her. She'd phone into Grandstand and we'd chat about, you know, this FIFA Women's World Cup, it's finally happening. And so to see it go from that to where we were in 2023, what significant changes. And again, you know, it's still not there, but it's so much further in a relatively short time. And things could have been done better. FIFA probably could have been more committed earlier. But I'll tell you what an amazing World Cup for so many different reasons, and credit to New Zealand as well as being remarkable co-hosts. But you know what it was like. And I've been writing a speech, which I'm giving on International Women's Day, about what it actually meant and why it seemed so significant. And I don't think we've actually dug deep enough yet to understand the full implications and the reasons why. But, you know, this team that we're lucky enough to have, that we're seeing go through this era now, the Matildas, have done something. You know, they've united the country, not in a way that is just a sort of fly-by-night thing. And I think what this team represents and what we saw right throughout the Women's World Cup was this level of support for good sporting teams that were all populated by women who've been through these struggles, who've sort of emerged on the other side and it's fully professional now, but from all these different cultures as well. And so to see sell-out stadiums for games that didn't even involve Australia is phenomenal and also says so much about what this country can draw on, because we've got people from everywhere. And we saw that and people were celebrating with each other, you know. Asians celebrating with South Americans because their team had done well, whatever. It was just all these different groups, but also the number of, and it's probably because I've been around for so long, and when I first started at the ABC, pretty much the entire audience was made up of men. And so a lot of these men now who are sort of older who stopped me when they saw me at World Cup events and were saying, wow, like, I didn't think I had any interest in women's sport, but this is amazing. The Matildas are great. Women's football is exceptional. I love being here. I love the atmosphere. It feels different to men's football. And so you've got, it's not just that all the young girls were happy. It was young girls, young boys, old boys, mothers, fathers, everybody. And it was a really galvanizing moment that I hope continues to grow, and I hope we continue to understand more about what it is and why it means so much. And I think it's just that we can all identify a little bit with that struggle, that sport, that moment.
What's so interesting about football as well, you cover all sports incredibly. Football, because it's so global, I wonder if that has also been a real point that allows you to explore people in the world. And I feel, and with Australia, it's still a sport where we have so much potential, where we can really show ourselves on the world stage. How has football been a real focus for you in amongst all the sports you cover?
Well, I've got to say, I always like to preface all of these sorts of answers with the fact that I'm a football outsider, okay? I'm not an insider, because there are so many football insiders. But the thing that really gets me is that you've got that insider arguing with that insider who are both arguing with that insider. It's like, can you just stop doing that? Because you all love football. And sometimes, and I get it, it's the passions, it's the history, it's the politics, all of those things, right? And everybody's struggling to get their part. So I do get it. But you're right, football is the global language. You know, football is the one thing where, you know, again, I just go back to Qatar or the streets here, Brisbane, Melbourne, any city you went to during the FIFA Women's World Cup, it unites people. And so for the sport to actually reach its full potential here in this country, it's got to unite. It's got to go forward together, you know, and these sort of petty politics have to be sort of put to aside for however they can manage to do that. But also don't discount this, that there's a whole lot of other sports in this country that don't want to see football really reach its full potential, and they'll be agitating from the side, creating problems or fanning those flames or making bigger headlines than are necessary in order to protect their product. And so I think, you know, football people need to be aware of that as well, that sometimes people who are kind of instigating these arguments, that they want you to fight because they don't want you to succeed or to overtake the position that they have. And I love rugby league, I love rugby union, I love AFL, maybe not so much, but, you know, I love all of them because people play sport for the same reasons. Yeah. And you get the same benefits whichever code you're playing, whichever sport you're playing. And those sports are great, but they will never, ever come anywhere close to football because people all around the world have been playing it, kicking round things along the ground forever, and that is never going to change.
One thought bubble on that, Tracy, is that maybe a really positive thing is that the Matilda's effect has seen all the other, you know, a rising tide lifts all the boats. So yeah, other economic opportunities have come available to AFLW players, and women's sport across the country has gained more prominence through hosting that tournament. So maybe that's a game changer in how people will think and move forwards. I wanted to know that, given the power, how would you change sport?
That's a really good question, and I don't know if I can answer it because I've always had, you know, a lot of the interviews I do have kind of focused on the power of sport. And I think the power that sport holds within itself is different to the power of those who are in charge and what they do with it. And I would be really wary if somebody said to anybody, here are the reins of power, because power does really strange things to people who, you know, I think most of them go in with good intentions, and there are a few, and it's not limited to sport. A lot of people think this is just sport. No, this is everything. This is any corporation. This is any government. This is any enterprise. There are people that definitely go in with not the right intentions. It's purely a personal pursuit of power. And so power is an interesting thing, which is why I like to look at, you know, different political systems and how they try and deal with power. And I don't think any political system has got it right. You know, democracy still has huge problems with power. You know, authoritarian regimes, we don't want that. They've got huge problems with power. Communist and socialist regimes where everybody's supposed to be equal, they've got huge problems with power. So I don't think anybody anywhere has actually mastered the true art of power for the benefit of all. I would argue, perhaps, that sport comes closest, and that is the way sport is played and the way that sport is accessible to all. That is the power, that it can touch every human being. Those in power, well, that's only going to be as good as the individual and his or her ability, you know, to keep a focus on what is the greater good. And we've seen that the more power people have, the less ability they seem to have to think about the greater good. So if someone said to me, I'm going to hand you, Tracy, all the power to make sport as good as it could be, I'd hand it back, because I haven't seen anyone able to do that, and I would be stupid to assume that I would be any different.
That's a really good answer. And it's actually, I loved it when you said that's a good question. I didn't think you'd say that, because that's a big compliment coming from you. So thank you. In the power that you did have, and why, another reason why I admire you and someone like Craig Foster, is behind the scenes, you did a lot to help people when you could. And one of those examples is in Afghanistan, the athletes who, after the Taliban were coming back into power around that Tokyo Olympics time, you did quite a lot to assist female footballers and athletes in general. Can you just tell us about what that was like behind the scenes and those levers you were able to pull?
Yeah, I remember, because it happened, the Taliban came back in to take over, you know, they were heading back towards Kabul towards the end of the Tokyo Olympics, which had been delayed by COVID. So it was in 2021 in August. And the whole time I was in Tokyo, I was listening to the world news and watching what was going on in Afghanistan and seeing that the Taliban was getting closer and closer to the capital city. And then when I flew back, we had to go straight into hotel quarantine for 2 weeks, and it coincided with the fall of Kabul. And I knew straight away that when that happened, I was going to phone Kalida Popal, who had been an Afghanistan footballer previously and had got out again, because of all sorts of challenges and abuse and the horrible situation that the female athletes there faced. So I rang Kalita and spoke to her and said, listen, what are the women in Afghanistan going through now? I think she was in Norway or, you know, one of the Nordic countries. Oh, and she did this interview and you could hear the pain and the fear and the fight in her voice. It was a really powerful interview. So I sent it straight through to the ABC to be used wherever it could be used. And then I got in touch with other women who were in Afghanistan who I was marginally aware of because I'd done some interviews with them previously. Anyway, every single interview I did, it was tragic. And also at the same time, the Olympics had finished and just a couple of weeks away, the Paralympics were about to begin. And I knew there were two athletes from Afghanistan who were due to compete in the Paralympics. Their chef de mission, the manager of their team, was based in London. And I rang him and I did an interview with him and I said, what's happening with your two athletes? He said, nothing. They're trapped. They're stuck. It's terrible. I said, well, who's helping? Like, what's the International Paralympic Federation doing? He said, nothing. Nothing they can do. I said, no, I don't accept that. So I rang the International Paralympic Committee. I said, what are you doing? And I did an interview with them. And, you know, I just kept doing all these interviews and put a whole lot of programs together with the interviews backed up. And then the people inside Afghanistan started sharing my number. And so I started getting calls and messages all through the night. And a friend of mine who was an Olympic swimmer for Canada who lives in Australia is a human rights lawyer. She rang me because she heard some of the interviews and said, okay, I'm on this. What can we do? Give me any numbers you can give me. She teamed up with another person and another person in London, and basically they started working on filling out all the paperwork that was needed to get people here on humanitarian visas, on emergency flights out of Afghanistan, and the flights were slowing down. You know, in a couple of days there were going to be no more flights. So in the end, I was really happy to be able to play an incredibly small part in getting the two Paralympians out and to the Paralympic Games. They both competed. It makes me so happy to think that they got there and I got to interview them while they were there. The football team, later the cricket team got out overland, also athletes. So the woman who carried the flag for Afghanistan at the Tokyo Olympic Games, she's now living in Australia and still competing. Yeah, and a whole lot of other, you know, family members and other people. But, oh, my gosh, you feel so insignificant. And even now I still get calls and messages from people saying, help me get out. And it's incredibly hard because you don't want to say no to anybody, but it requires a whole machine to work, you know. It requires, and like you say, people like Craig Foster, people like my friend Nikki Dryden, and her friends that came together, and teams of people, you know, that became active, and sports bodies. The Australian Olympic Committee has done a lot. Cricket Australia has done a lot. You know, we know that many of the Afghan footballers living in Melbourne and the football clubs there have done a lot. So it requires so many people to help out. And this is why you think this ridiculous fighting, like what do people do to each other? Why do they do it? For what point?
Sometimes,
anyway, that's a much bigger topic.
Another big topic is that I think about when it comes to sports and the IOC and Olympic Games is, what is the purpose of a country? What does a country mean? Mm. The world can be so deeply unjust that your visa, you know, where you can visit in the world is based on where you're born, what land you're born in. And
which is an accident.
Yeah.
It's just an accident. You don't choose which country you're born in. And, you know, passports, there's a great book. What was it called? Citizenship. And it was written by a Russian guy who's been completely kind of sidelined now and discredited for other things that he'd done. But the book that he wrote about citizenship just had so many great points because, yes, it was all about that, you know. And even when we talk about things, you know, people say to me, because I do, for all its faults, I love the Olympics. And people say, oh, yeah, but Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who founded the modern Olympic Games, he was a misogynist. It's like, yeah, hello, 1896, they all were. And this is the difficulty. And we're talking about back then, what were, I don't know, how many countries competed, maybe 20 in the beginning. Half the countries that compete today didn't exist 100 years ago. So, you know, that just shifts all the time. And there's these imaginary kind of borders and people fight, no, this is mine and that's yours. And it's kind of silly. I'm sure that in 1,000 years, maybe longer, if anyone is still around, if we haven't blown the planet up or, you know, made the climate so bad we've all burnt or drowned, but people will look at some of the things we fight over now and think, what on earth were they thinking? Mm. How small-minded were they?
Wow, that's a very powerful one too, to think that far ahead. And this minuscule moment in time that we live in, and when we...
It's tiny, isn't it?
Yeah. And
this is the other thing about, you know, you talk about power before and what people want to flex their muscles and I'm in charge and I get to dictate, and it's like, you know, you're here for that. We're all like little ants, like here, and someone's going to squash you tomorrow, you're gone. Like, what are you carrying on about?
One of the ants, if there was an ant or a person that you could ever interview that you haven't yet, is there anyone on that list, Tracy?
Oh, look, there's so many people. yeah, so many people. But I'd like to be able to sort of go back in time and forward in time, you know. I would love to interview all the great explorers, because it's like, what was your understanding of your little world before you began exploring, before you sailed to the edge and found out that it kept going and there were other places and there were people who looked different or behaved different or ate different? And what did you think afterwards? You know, it's like, there's some great books that have been written about the people, the very few people that have walked on the moon. That's a really small club. But every single one of them, it's fascinating if you read their stories, because, you know, they think about their world. They live on this earth as we do, and they had this idea. And then they gradually pull back into space and they see that, you know, the earth doesn't have sunlight and nighttime. It's constantly shrouded in darkness. It's this little blue thing in the darkness. And they had never thought like that before. And then they get to the moon and they look back and suddenly everything they thought is completely flipped, because we just aren't that important. And when you eradicate that sense of self-importance, it changes everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it changes the relationships that you have with people. It changes how you want to spend your time and what is relevant and what is irrelevant, and what is just wasting time and not really achieving anything. So, you know, people that have been able to think to so completely differently, you know, wouldn't it be great to be able to sit down with Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, you know, pick a whole lot of them and go, okay, tell me about your world before you became who you were and the power that that gave you, and how did you think differently afterwards? You know, and how do you look at us now? I mean, imagine that. They're the people I'd love to interview. It's not going to happen.
One person you did interview was Shane Warne, and you asked him, are there people or moments over your journey, all the places you've been to, people you met in your life that really stand out as moments that helped you see the world differently?
Yes. Did I ask Shane Warne that?
Yes, you did. You asked him in an interview pretty recently, and it was re-aired after he passed away, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it was
that was
a good
one of
question.
The ones from the Chapel Foundation dinner. That's where they were raising money for youth homelessness.
And
yeah.
And that's when he said, good question, which is always a good sign.
Well, I got on very well with Shane, and a lot of people are surprised by that. because, you know, he had this reputation, not even a reputation. I mean, he had a lot of, you know, he enjoyed his life. But I got on very well with Shane, and I always had great chats with Shane. Any interview that I had, and I used to ring him infrequently, but when I lived in Dubai, I remember working at the radio station then, ringing him to do an interview, and he did it. He always said yes, and he was always very giving of his time. And what I liked about Shane is that, you know, here's this very Aussie bloke, almost someone who wasn't from the 70s but was trapped in that era, yeah. Like had that kind of a, you know, white Aussie mentality. And he took himself all around the world, you know, and he got to meet different people and mix in different circles, but he never changed. So he was always true to himself, and I really admire that in people. And so he always, I think, made for really interesting discussions when you took him outside that sort of cricket space, which, again, he was so good at, and I loved his commentary on cricket because you got real insights. But, you know, life is much more than just a game. And, you know, so you do meet people who change you. You do meet people who make you think differently, both good and bad. One person, there's lots of people, but I remember interviewing Arthur Ashe, you know, who was the first black man to win Wimbledon. And again, you know, at the time, very white sport, very white era. Here he was having to wear all white and what he had to put up with throughout his career. And then he had an operation later on in life, and the blood transfusion he got during that operation had AIDS. The blood had AIDS. And so he was dying of AIDS that came through this transfusion, not through any other reason. And I remember asking him, when you don't have long to look forward, what do you look forward to? And he said, I'm looking forward to my daughter's next birthday because I might not get there, but I might, and I hope I do. And again, it was a real lesson in perspective. And, you know, that's the one thing I always try and come back to, and that is perspective, because we can pull back, we can hone in, we can look from that side and that side, and it's only then that you get a true picture of anything, you know, looking at it from as many sides as possible. And so I think perspective is one of my favourite words.
Is there anything that you that helps you to always maintain that sense of perspective? Because you know what life is like. There's always distractions and things that suck you in. And
yeah,
what helps you to anchor that thought or way of thinking?
So I think growing up, I always thought of myself at a very young age as a bit of a Buddhist. I'm not going to say a Buddhist, because people who truly, you know, dedicate their lives to being Buddhists, I'm not anywhere close. But that idea that you shrink yourself to nothing. So, you know, when you meditate, just go to emptiness and nothing, so that you're not there anymore. And so if you can see a world happening in front of you that you're not part of, then you can see it quite clearly, because you don't have any of those emotional ties, you know. You're not bound up in being part of the story. And so I always try and remove myself or any feelings I have from that story, because it's not my story, it's somebody else's story, and I just happen to be there at that time, and it's my job to document it or talk about it. And I don't always get that right, because, of course, I'm bringing my own interpretation to it. But yeah, I try and do that a lot. I try and remove myself, like I'm not there. Like, let's say as a physical being, I'm not here. There's just a mind, and my mind is comprehending what's happening in front of it, but I'm not any part of that. I think that helps, and I try and do that a lot.
Through meditation?
Yeah, I do meditation, but I remember a Buddhist monk who was a friend of ours in Hong Kong, and I remember him saying, you know, the art of meditation is not to go away for a month and sit in a dark cave and zone out. The art of meditation is to be able to find that mindset every minute of every day, so that even amongst everything that's happening in a day, all the traffic that's whizzing by, all the people that are making demands on your time, families, people who are sick, bills to pay, amongst all of that, you've got to find a space where you're in that little cave mentally. And that is when meditation actually benefits you most, when you know that you can just hop into that spot amongst all of the drama of every day. And that's true meditation. I haven't mastered that art yet, but I keep thinking about it.
That's the start, isn't it?
It is.
Tracy, I'm mindful of your time, but something I also wanted to bring back was coming to Australia and Stan Grant, or Stan Holmes, as he's also known as in China. Your husband is also someone who's a wonderful, incredible Australian. And I reflect on reconciliation and how Australia can move forward after what's happened in 2023 with the no vote. What are your reflections on how Australia can truly come to terms with truth telling and reconciliation?
I don't know. I really don't know. And what I saw after the no vote, and it's impossible for anyone who is not Indigenous to be able to understand it fully, but I can only tell you what I saw and how I comprehend that. And so what I saw was, because it was so overwhelmingly no in every state, Indigenous people who thought they were being accepted as equals in this country suddenly started doubting themselves and everyone else again. Because, and I know this for a fact, like in the immediate aftermath of the vote, you'd walk down the street and, you know, normally you walk down the street, smile at people, you don't smile at people, you know, just people passing. People would see my husband and look the other way. And so how's he meant to interpret that? Like, are they looking the other way because until yesterday we could walk along and smile and, you know, we share the same space, but did they vote no yesterday and that's why they won't make eye contact with me now? You know, that's a very hard thing to bear. And I can see it and I can empathise with it, but I can't fully understand the depth of that despair, that they feel so judged, so negatively, so, I don't know, it's almost like there's a meanness, you know. They are this country's first people. They have 60,000 years of understanding of this place. And we don't want to tap into that by giving them, you know, what essentially was a pretty meager kind of thing, you know, a voice with no power, but just a voice that we could at least listen to in trying to determine what was best for all of us. And, I think it was very, very difficult and remains so for many First Nations people.
Thank you, Tracy. And there's a new project you are immersed in which allows you to do what you do in a wonderful way, which is the Sport Ambassador, and it's definitely something we want to encourage listeners to get around, because it is constant stream of amazing amazing people from sport, once again, just like the ticket, but more regular, it feels. Tell us about that experience for you now immersing into this project and your podcasting skills as well being put to the test.
They are. So for 7 years at the ABC, I did, predominantly a weekly show called The Ticket. And I did that myself. I think it was the only 1 hour of radio in the entire ABC that was made by one person. And so in-depth discussions with people who are quite influential in sport, you know, whether it's from admin or athletes or lots of people in between. And so I'd mix it and, you know, put it up online and get it ready for the studio to play on a Sunday. And then when I left the ABC, I asked if I could take it with me because I kind of built up quite a loyal following and I love my loyal listeners. They're really fabulous. Anyway, the ABC said no, even though they had no intention of continuing the program because there's not one person who would research it that way, have the connections in international global sport, edit it together, stay there till 3 a.m. on a Saturday or Sunday morning to get it ready for air on a Sunday night. Anyway, they said no. So I had to come up with a new name. And so I've called it the Sports Ambassador because I think everyone that you speak to about sport in some way is a sports ambassador. Because if you're talking about it, whether you're an athlete or whether it's people like you and me that have an interest in it or volunteers or coaches or presidents of governing bodies or organising committees, all of us in some way are ambassadors for sport. And so I thought, yep, that's good. And it also, I hope, elevates some of the conversations. So it's not about tearing down any institutions. I had a discussion with my youngest son today, actually, who's not a kid, he's 22, you know, and he's a YouTuber and he can teach me a thing or two, I can tell you. But I had a chat with him about, you know, don't criticize something unless you're also prepared to try and come up with a solution, because criticizing and tearing things apart is so easy. But what's your answer? And so I always hope that discussions that I have, even sometimes in the most tragic kind of detail, because some of the topics are not pleasant, many of them are, but you don't want to just tear at something because you don't like it, don't agree with it, don't whatever. What's your solution? And unless you're trying to contribute to finding those solutions or finding a better way, or coming up with a strategy that is going to benefit more people, then criticism for criticism's sake is pointless. Mm. And so I always hope that there's that forward momentum in the discussions that I'm lucky enough to have with people from all around the world. And I hope it helps us understand each other a bit more. And I hope it helps us lead to making sport even better than it already is. And I hope it also leads to understanding, you know, an acceptance that we are different and we're allowed to be different. And just because we're different doesn't mean we have to fight with each other.
That's a very good message for us to pull up the stumps for this episode, Tracy. It was really fantastic. And as a sports ambassador yourself, congratulations on being selected as an Olympic torchbearer for Paris 2024 as well. You excited for
I've
that?
I've forgotten about that for a minute.
What does that involve? So at what point in the torch relay will you be part of it if you know yet?
Well, I'm expecting them to change it because they told me I'm running on the day of the opening ceremony.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I won't be lighting the cauldron, I can promise you that. But if it's on the day of the opening, I mean, that's pretty special. So it'll be very close to, you know, the centre of Paris somewhere.
That's amazing. That's so good. Yeah, that's really fantastic. So, Tracy, thank you so much for your time, for your work over the years and in the future as well. I know when you won the Lifetime Media Award with the Australian Sports Commission, you said, this is like not even halfway into the journey. So, yeah, that's fantastic. And there's so many great philosophies that I've even learned a lot from this. So thank you so much and wishing you all the best.
Abid, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate what you do too, so keep doing it. You're carrying the torch as well.
And there we have it. That was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for listening. As a community-cultivated, independent podcast, your support means the world, so we can keep these important conversations flowing, taking Wally Lup to the world and the world to Wally Lup. Until next time, keep smiling, keep scoring.